Cafeo Now is presented by Northwest Financial Advisors, where our world revolves around you.
Hello, everyone. This is Jim Hughes with Cafeo Now. We are a program of recorded interviews with former senior U.S. intelligence officers and those who write about them. Today, I have a very good host and a special guest. My co-host's name is Linda Millis. She is former NSA, CIA, DNI, the White House, and the President's Commission on Intelligence Reform. She has a bachelor's degree from the University of Maryland in Russian Studies and MA from Johns Hopkins in International Public Policy. She is currently an assistant professor at Marymount University, where she runs the intelligence program, and I'm very pleased to say a member of the AFIO board. Linda, welcome back to AFIO Now.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you for that kind invitation. So today, it's really my pleasure to host Liza Munda here, who has actually become a friend of mine, and I'm very proud of that. But today, I invited her here to talk about her new book, The Sisterhood, The Secret History of the Women of the CIA. So Liza, first off, I'm just kind of wondering why. What made you want to write this book?
Well, thank you for your introduction, Linda. And before I answer the question, I just want to thank you for your help with the book. You gave me, you know, an interview when I was doing the reporting. And they're only, I mean, I can think of a couple of interviews where points and themes and insights stuck with me throughout the writing of the book. And yours was one of those, particularly the points that you made about the change in the nature of intelligence work from the Cold War to the counterterrorism period and the sorts of moral calculus that had to be made by analysts and operations officers. And I really kept that thought in my mind the whole time. It was very helpful. So I just want to thank you for your help on that end. And also later on. So what made me want to do this book is my prior book, Code Girls, as you know, looks at the cohort of women, more than 10,000 women who came to Washington during World War II to learn to become code breakers. And that was eye-opening reporting for me with, you know, women in their 90s who had served the war effort, had served the intelligence community and helped build our modern intelligence capabilities and had never spoken about their work and never gotten any credit. This really huge untold story, as it turned out. And I knew the whole time I was reporting this that there was a parallel cohort of women who were recruited into the espionage and in intelligence analysis of the civilian spy service, the OSS, at the same time, thousands of women who came to do that work. And so I had always been intrigued by their story. I mean, as a home cook, of course, like all home cooks, I worship at the shrine of Julia Child, that part of her biography and part of what, you know, led to her meeting her husband and then going to France with him and becoming Julia Child was related to her war service in the OSS. That's just a small detail. But I was always intrigued by that part of the World War II narrative in terms of our creation of a civilian spy service. And I also knew, even from my Code Girls reporting, that some of those women stayed on during the Cold War, just as they did in the spy service, and that women who served during the Cold War made striking contributions and also striking personal sacrifices. I knew that there was, at the NSA, that there was a cohort of women who stayed on with the Venona Project, with the Russian code-breaking project. And I actually done a piece for Smithsonian about the Venona women who, none of them married, none of them had children. That was, you know, a great personal sacrifice that they made in order to continue with their public service and their intelligence contributions. So with the sisterhood, when I started interviewing women who either stayed on after the war or joined up during the Cold War, I was riveted by their contributions and also very interested in writing about what it was like to serve in the intelligence community, what it was like to serve overseas at a time when America had retreated into this very conventional view of women and their roles and what happens when a woman becomes married, what her duties are, which was really a complex and interesting part of the book. Both the way the U.S. government felt that wives should be expected to contribute wholeheartedly to their husbands' intelligence careers, but also that women who had joined the CIA would be expected to resign upon getting married. So to really try and delve into what that meant for the women who were either serving as unpaid wives or attempting to push back against these stereotypes was really endlessly interesting to me because it went on for so long.
Yeah, I want to also say that I really loved your book, The Code Girls. And, you know, you featured in that book one of my mentors, Miss Ann Carrick Christie, who was the right. former deputy director of NSA, who I knew up until the day that she passed. And so I was really happy to be that. But in your new book, you know, you write about a lot of really interesting women. I was curious to know if there was one story or one interview that really stood out to you as kind of maybe a favorite or even a story.
Well, there are a lot of characters in the sisterhood. And in part, that was because everybody that I talked to had an interesting story. And I was intrigued by this sort of larger theme of women building a network over the years and in a really multi-generational way, because it took such a long time. I think one of my favorite interviews to embroider on this theme of women's and wives' service during the Cold War. As I think you know, I tried to interview Shirley Sulik, a CIA wife who seems to have been so charismatic and so well-liked and such a beloved member of the intelligence community. And I was emailing with her before she went into the hospital for her last treatment. And we were prepared to have an interview after that. And unfortunately, she didn't survive that trip into the hospital. And I was very sorry not to get to talk to her. It was very meaningful to have a conversation about her with her husband, Mike Sulik, who is such a remarkably well-regarded officer, served in the clandestine service, as you know, better than I. And to hear a CIA officer pay tribute to his wife and her service, I was very moving and also just very interesting, you know, to hear him describe what it was like to be a case officer in Moscow when he was serving and the physicality of that job. I mean, I had not appreciated, and I think many people don't appreciate, just lay observers, how physical that job was, how much of it entailed eluding surveillance. I mean, just plain old eluding surveillance. And Mike was very, very vivid and funny, as you know, yeah. about the number of surveillance cars that would descend upon you whenever you left a parking garage. And so all of the tradecraft that was devoted just to getting away from your surveillers. And then really when he paid tribute to the role that Shirley played in his career and her story of somebody, African-American woman who was in politics, presumably a very patriotic person who believed in the American mission and served with such zest, it sounds like. And so that was writing about the contributions of wives, Barbara Colby as well, and the operation that she ran in order to get financial recognition for wives' service. That whole part of the book was one of my favorites.
Yeah, I was a friend of Shirley's too, and she really was a force, you know, so I think a lot of people know her. And serving in Moscow in the Cold War when Mike was the chief of station was really challenging. And my favorite story from Shirley was always how the Soviets killed her cat. And she was convinced of that. So was there anything when you were writing and researching this book and talking to people that really kind of surprised you? Or was it still more of just kind of a continuation of what you had learned from the Code Girls?
Well, one of the things that surprised me about the reporting was that people, including retired clandestine officers, were more willing to talk to me than yeah. I had anticipated their being. I had not reported on the CIA before this. My experience with intelligence reporting had been the women who were code breakers during the war, who by this time were in their 90s. They knew, or at least they could be convinced, that the story had been declassified as it had been. And so, you know, once they got started, to the extent that they could remember, they would, I think, pretty much tell me just about anything. A couple of them, there were some terms of art that they were still not willing to share, but by and large, they were, you know, comfortable telling their stories. And I really didn't know what it would be like trying to report on CIA activities. And I think that I hope that some of the people I talked to felt that this story had been fairly told in Code Girls. And so, because it is a big responsibility when somebody entrusts you with talking about their life and their life story and their work as well. I had a colleague at the Washington Post. I learned a lot from him. And when he was talking to somebody about whether they would agree to be profiled for the Washington Post, he would say to them, you know, I understand this is my job. This is your life. And I do understand that and take it very seriously. So I was happily surprised that people were willing to tell me their stories or the parts of their stories that they felt that they could. And I think everybody had a clear sense of what they could and couldn't say. And I think, you know, these stories are so interesting, and the lives, particularly of clandestine officers at times, are so surreal, that it's just, I would imagine it's hard, even though I know people have passed testing showing that they can keep these secrets. The parts of it that can be told are so compelling. I was just glad that it turned out that enough people were willing to talk to make a book.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I was really pleasantly surprised when I read the book at the level of detail and the level of sharing from some of the stories. And I think that if anybody, and when they read the book, they too will be surprised at the, you know, at the level of detail that was shared. So, you know, I was thinking, I know this book is about the sisterhood and about the women, but I wondered if you had any comment about the men that you talked about in the book and how they treated the women. Was there different kinds?
I'm sorry, what?
Were there different kinds of men, some who were more open to it?
Yes. So I think it was really, you know, a mixed story. I think that what we see in the CIA in the Cold War is what today we would call institutional sexism, in that there was a very rigid division of labor that held, as one female reports officer put it to me, the men worked outdoors and the women worked indoors. Mm-hmm. So in the clandestine service, women were expected to be reports officers. And then at headquarters, women were working in the archives. Women were hired into the analytic directorate, you know, in increasing numbers as the years went on. But the assumption would be that women would be in the desk jobs or the staff jobs, but not so much the case officer positions. And so that reflected both, you know, it reflected to a certain extent the personal thinking of many individual men, particularly the architects of the clandestine service, who were themselves a very small cohort of, you know, entitled, often at the beginning, wealthy white men from elite backgrounds. I know they weren't all from elite backgrounds, but they were. So this wasn't necessarily the thinking of all men, but it was the thinking of this cohort. And so it was put in place, this institutional division of labor. But I was putting together a slideshow for some of the book talks that I give, and I was plucking some of the stereotypical comments that male officers didn't hesitate to give investigators during the course of several investigations over the years. There was the Petticoat Panel in the 1950s. There was the T. Thompson lawsuit, or originally EEOC complaint, and then escalated to a discrimination lawsuit that was settled. And clearly during those decades, individual men also had no problem sharing stereotypical views. You know, the minute a woman gets married, she doesn't want to work anymore. Women won't travel. Richard Helms, I got to say, said some really shocking, you know, if these gals come here and they think the government's going to fall apart because their brains aren't being used to the fullest, well, you know, they can just think again. Like he had no hesitation. You know, there's all this turnover in the clerks. The minute a woman gets married, she just doesn't want to work anymore. They don't want to do any kind of work that will dirty their hands. Like, it was shocking to hear just the sort of freedom with which these views were expressed by some individuals who were named. But I also want to be careful to say that some of the women I interviewed for my book, like Heidi August, went out of their way to say that they were mentored by men, certainly much more than by women like Eloise Page, who, as far as I can tell, didn't mentor anybody. But Heidi was mentored by David Whipple, by the officer who recommended, because she was hired as a clerk and spent 10 years clerking in overseas stations around the world. And then it was her male station chief who said, you know, your skills go beyond a clerk's job and or you know, assistant's job, and you should convert tracks and go to the farm and try to join the clandestine, the professional track, as it was called back then. So it was also striking to me that there were a number of female officers who I would say were mentored more by men than by women, in part because there weren't that many women in the clandestine service, but in part because if you were a woman in the clandestine service, at least in the early years, you had to make it clear that you weren't a feminist. Yeah. Or in the case of Eloise Page, she just didn't really want to mentor other women, it seems like. So yeah, so but you know, even somebody like Heidi's boss, David Whipple, he really was a mentor to her and believed in her abilities, but she said, you know, he hated organized feminism. So there you go.
Yeah, I hope a lot of men read the book. You know, I hope a lot of men take the time to read the book. So
yeah, I'm sorry, just somebody like Mike Sulick. I interviewed Patricia Moynihan, who was a case officer who was instrumental in the capture of Mir Amal Khanzi. And she worked for Mike in Moscow. And, you know, she was so praising of his mentorship as a boss. So I hope that the book doesn't come across as, you know, a blanket condemnation of the men of the CIA. I think, if anything, it was the institutional setup that prevailed for so long. So sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, that's okay. I think I agree. There's a lot of really good stories on both sides. So I'm just hoping a lot of men take the time to read the book. So I have one question for you, a specific one that caught my eye. In the beginning of the book, in your author's note, you said one of the reasons that you wrote the book was that you were wondering if one of the reasons the 9/11 attacks seemed to catch America's leaders so flat-footed was because of the sexism and the women's difficulty in getting their institutional buy-in to what they were seeing. So, you know, after your research, what did you get an answer to that question, or, you know, a conclusion on that, what you were wondering?
Yeah, I do think that the gender of the analysts who were early on calling attention to Al-Qaeda was one reason that they weren't listened to. I mean, I try to sort of trace the complicated, again, it's sort of an institutional issue in that when the Counterterrorism Center at the CIA was created in the mid-1980s, when Dewey Claridge moved for it to be created, it wasn't a prestigious place to be. And it became known, I mean, some people described it as a dumping ground. If you were an ambitious officer, you didn't want to be there, particularly during the Cold War. But then even after that, in part because you couldn't make a career there, you had to go there on loan from your home division. And so you would be out of sight, out of mind to your own boss who was responsible for your promotion. And so for some institutional reasons, women found their way into the Counterterrorism Center and therefore were well positioned to spot the threat of Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. So sometimes, like, if I would ask the analyst Barbara Sood, do you think that women were looked down upon or that sexism was the reason that you all weren't listened to the way you might have been or should have been sooner? And she said, well, counterterrorism was looked down on. Yeah. And so, but then again, okay, counterterrorism was looked down on. Therefore, more women found that were sort of channeled into that unit. So it's a chicken and egg kind of thing. But I do think that that gender played a role in that. Yeah.
So I just got one last question for you. So, you know, Code Girls and this book, I think you're becoming one of the well-known historians of women who serve in the intelligence community in the CIA. So I was wondering if maybe you had some advice for the women who want to serve, you know, young women out there, you know, like for my students and other young women who are considering a career in intelligence or in the CIA. Do you have some advice to share with them?
Well, I think I would hope that if nothing else, if they read this book, they'll understand that there are some common hardships. And one of the And that if they join the intelligence community and they find themselves experiencing hardships, they shouldn't think that they're alone in that. One of the young women in the book, the younger clandestine officer, is Molly Chambers, who gets almost a chapter to herself in the book, who served after 9/11, was motivated in part by 9/11, which occurred when she was a young teenager. And she said after she read the whole book that she found it, the word she used was healing, to see that the hardships that she had experienced serving in Africa in very hard, lonely places where, you know, some of the attributes that are displayed by, say, the early male station chiefs, like alcoholism, you know, like a lot of drinking in these outposts. I think she saw the same sorts of vulnerabilities even now, because it is so grindingly lonely being in dangerous places where you can't even really venture outside the compound where you're stationed, where you socialize really pretty much with your colleagues. Patricia Moynihan described this as well when she was in Pakistan, that it was a dangerous place. And so you're shut up. And I think Molly felt, you know, like, I don't know if this is more of a female attribute, but any time that she felt like something was particularly hard or might have gone wrong, she was inclined to blame herself. And I'm hopeful that, and she articulated this, that sort of reading about the experiences of other officers throughout the generation, she understood that, oh, no, actually, this is part of the experience. Right. And so it was helpful, at least to her, to see that she was part of a continuum, and that some of the challenges hadn't changed that much over the years. So I don't know if that's a direct answer to your question, but, you know, it's always helpful. You know, it's helpful as a journalist also to know that if a part of the book is hard to write, if there are certain times where it feels like a battle or a struggle to make sense of what you've reported, to know that that's normal. That's a normal part of the process. So I would hope that anybody, male or female, who reads this book and reads about the hardships would know to a certain extent that this is a normal part of the process. It's not you.
Right.
And there, you know, there are challenges that have gone away. Some of the sexism has gone away. The ban on gay and lesbian officers has gone away. But there are challenges that aren't ever going to go away because they're part of the nature of the job, seems to me.
Right. Well, you know, I think things are changing. You know, I'm old enough to have been around for a while, so I've seen some change. So I really appreciate your time and the books. And I hope everyone who's listening gets the book and takes the time to read it. So that, I guess that's enough. Jim, did you have anything you wanted to add here at the end?
Well, the book is called The Sisterhood.
Thank you.
It sounds like a must read. And I want to thank both.
I happen to have a copy here.
I want to thank both Liza Mundy and Linda Billis for a really very interesting interview.
Thank you. Thanks so much, Linda, for all your help.
Thanks so much. See you later. Bye.
AFIO is a small, nonprofit, apolitical, educational organization whose main mission is to help prepare the next generation of intelligence officers to confront the challenges our nation faces in the years ahead. To learn more or support our outreach programs, visit www.afio.com.